Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcasts. I'm Joanna Penn, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options, internet sales and promotion for your book. The companion website is www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, this is Joanna Penn for the Creative Pen Podcast. And today I'm interviewing Alan Baxter. Alan is the author of dark fantasy novels Realm Shift and Mage Sign, as well as many short stories. He also owns an independent publishing company, Blade Red Press, and his novels have just been picked up by Griffinwood Press. You can find his blog, his stories and novel information at www.alanbaxteronline.com. So welcome, Alan.
Hi there, thanks.
Yeah, it's great to have you on, and congratulations on the Griffinwood deal. That's very exciting. So maybe you can start by telling us briefly a bit about you, about your books, and about the deal.
Okay. Well, a bit about me. I'm born and raised English and now live in Australia. Started writing seriously when I moved to Australia in the mid-90s. Realm Shift is my first novel. It's fundamentally a thriller. It's a dark fantasy thriller. Basically boils down to there's one guy that has a very important job to do, but he's a bit of a coward. So this powerful, immortal fellow has to go and help him do it, but the devil doesn't want it done. So there's a lot of chasing around going on and magic and mayhem and stuff like that. The sequel to it is Mage Sign, which I released at the start of year before, 2008. And that follows the same main character on his way to try to track down the person that taught the bad guy in the first book. So they're both independent books. You can read either of them either, you know, on their own, but they do follow as a duology if you want to read them together. So it's mainly about having fun with religious mythology and action and magic and martial arts and intrigue. So, and Griffinwood Press in the US have just picked up the books, which is very exciting. They're a small press in the US that I'd had some dealings with in the past, so I'm really pleased that they've picked up the books and they're looking to release them at the end of April, April 27th, which would have been my dad's birthday, so that seems strangely fortuitous.
Oh, that's absolutely fantastic. And, you know, from an indie author to another indie author, you know, it's great to see you sort of getting up there. And so we're looking forward to more stuff from you. Okay, so I wanted to ask you about a couple of things today. First off, I guess, is that Realm Shift and Mage Sign have these magical and religious mythological themes and supernatural characters. You've got the devil in there. You've got, I suppose one would say God, but you don't call him God, do you? You have a different word.
Well, yeah, I've got all kinds of gods and creatures that all sort of sit under the umbrella of an entity known as the Balance in the books, and the main character is an agent of the Balance and fundamentally trying to stop the gods arguing amongst each other.
And so I guess, you know, my question is, because I'm writing a sort of semi-religious thriller at the moment using myths and figures that people already kind of know about. So why did you particularly focus on these themes in the first place?
I think it comes from a deep-seated interest. It fascinates me, I suppose, on the one hand, and here I am about to alienate all the religious people, but it fascinates me that people can be religious where they can look at all these different mythologies that are in the world, all kinds of myths and legends, and then they'll go, you know, all of those are crap, but that one's true. And they'll follow that when it's something that's nothing really determines it from anything else. There's so much crossover, so much similarity between creation myths and sun worship and all these sorts of things. And in studying religion and religious mythology and all these things, I just became more and more interested in the concept of belief and those mythologies. And that kind of is what informs the books.
You said you studied religion then. Is that a degree?
Well, not formally, but yeah, I never studied anything very well when it came to school. I left school at 17 without much to my name because I was never very good at it. But I was always fascinated by the English subjects and writing and creative writing, and I just read voraciously, and I probably studied more since I left school than I ever did in school, just studying the things I choose to learn about.
Mm. And did you incorporate your own beliefs, or is it literally just an interest of yours?
I suppose it's a little of both in some ways. I don't really have much in the way of beliefs in a conventional sense, but I think it's probably impossible to go into a novel-length work like that without it being informed at least by some of how I feel about things. I try to make a point of, like, within the book, within the first book, there are a handful of primary characters. And there's the main character that just travels around between all the realms and knows full well that all the gods and all the heavens and all the hells and everything exist because people believe in them. And then there's a character that has a very strict belief about one particular realm, and then there are characters that don't believe in anything. And so we're playing these ideas off against each other, and I suppose a little bit of me probably informs each character.
Mm. And do you think that bringing these sort of myths, because some of your gods are quite, you know, well known and people would recognise their names, do you think bringing existing myths into writing makes the books more accessible, or that people resonate more with them?
Yeah, I think so, to some degree. I mean, it works both ways, because you get people that take their beliefs very seriously that get very upset about it. I actually had, back in the day when I first wrote Realm Shift and was shopping it around to various publishers, I had one publisher that was clearly quite a devout Christian that sent my manuscript back with notes scrawled all over it, and just this vitriolic hatred of everything I'd written, which said a lot more about him than it did about me. So it kind of works both ways, but I think that using established mythology, people recognise, you know, the main characters. In my books, you'll find the angel Gabriel takes a fairly hands-on, large role in it. Gods crop up all the time. The protagonist, Isaiah, just talks among gods like he would talk among children. They annoy him because they're these, you know, insecure creatures that need their people's belief and stuff like that. So you get to play with these incredible characters that have been created over centuries in myths and legends, and just, you know, muck around with them in a modern novel.
Mm. Well, it's funny you say that about the publisher then, because that was another one of my questions, was really, you know, are you concerned that you might offend people? Or I guess you're also in the sort of dark fantasy realm. Do you expect to offend people?
Yeah, I don't really care if I offend people is probably the bottom line. I don't really believe in blasphemy. If you choose to believe in something, then that's entirely up to you. But if other people believe differently, even if they believe that you're a fool for what you believe, that's their right as well. So I don't believe in blasphemy. If someone said a giant pink jellyfish circles the moon and I worship him, everybody would laugh them out of the room. But when someone says, oh, this bearded guy that created the earth in 6 days looks over us all and looks out for us, and apparently you're not allowed to laugh at that because that's religion. So I don't believe in blasphemy. I don't really believe in offending people. If people take offence, that's more their insecurity than mine. I can say what I like about it. It's free speech. We can all say what we like. You don't have to read it. If you don't like it, that's fine.
Mm. No, I love this topic because, you know, I'm writing on the religious sort of themes myself, and it's quite hard to know what line to tread with. Sorry, carry on.
I think if you start trying to censor yourself and you start worrying about offending people, then you're going to compromise what it is that you want to write. I think it's important to write whatever it is that you feel needs to be written. You need to tell the story that you have to tell. And if that offends some people, then, hey, sorry, don't read it. You know, next time you see a book by me, you'll know not to buy it. But, I think it's going to really restrict what you're trying to do if you're second-guessing all the time whether people are going to be offended. Like, some people actually challenged me when this came up. When I was writing the sequel, they said, oh, we'll see if you really believe that or not. Why don't you write something with Muhammad and have him give Muhammad a talking part? Because it's really blasphemous against the Islamic people is to represent Muhammad. And he does actually crop up in Mage Sign, but it didn't work for the story, really, to give him a speaking part, so...
Yeah, no, fair enough. And there's no need to actually court controversy. You just
exactly.
Yeah, you tell your story and see what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you and I mean, being, I mean, sort of Western, I guess, even though there's lots of Muslims in England, I feel personally that the Christian myths and religion are far closer to my heritage, I guess, so I don't feel informed enough to write about Islam.
I've done a lot of reading and a lot of research. I probably know as much about Islam as I do about Christianity, as I do about Judaism and Haitian voodoo, because it's just a subject that I'm just fascinated by. And I think probably the Judeo-Christian myths are a little bit more familiar to me just because I grew up in England, which is a fundamentally Judeo-Christian society. So you can't help but absorb these things. People incorporate these religious themes and stories into things without even realizing they're doing it half the time. You just, growing up in an Islamic country, obviously, would give you a very different perception of world religions than growing up in a Christian country or a Hindu country or whatever. But I do try to make sure that I sort of study all these different things as equally as possible, and I try to draw on all of them. They're fascinating stories. All of them are fantastic stories.
Oh, absolutely. So you've had sort of one tip there about not censoring yourself and writing your story. Do you have any other tips for people wanting to write with the sort of supernatural themes? Because I guess, you know, not that you're on any way the same as Stephanie Meyer, but I mean, you know, werewolves and, you know, vampires and that type of thing are still in the supernatural realm, and lots of people want to write about that now. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, do you have any other sort of tips for that or recommendations for research?
Well, I mean, I think with genre writing or otherwise, the fundamental tip is just read. Just read as much as you can, because the more informed you are, the more you've read, the more styles and stories that you've come across, the more rounded you're going to be as a writer. But I think it's important, especially in genre writing, particularly if you're using established mythologies to weave your story around, I think it's important to be informed about those things, because there are people that know. It's like with science fiction, a lot of people get very upset when the science is completely hokey, and it just, well, that could never happen in a million years simply because it's against the laws of thermodynamics or whatever. You've got to be a little bit like that within your genre realm as well. If you're writing with religious mythology or you're picking on the vampire sort of subject, you need to know what's gone before, even if you're going to change it, so that you can change it properly and in an informed way, because people know their stuff and they like their stuff, and if you're going to play with it, they'll be ready to read it, but you've got to do a good job of it, you know.
No, that's excellent. Yeah, these are all things I'm really interested in at the moment myself, because I'm trying to do nothing similar to your book, but, you know, with a similar sort of religious idea. So I guess on that as well, you do write some quite graphic violence and horror, and, you know, you're a dark fantasy writer, and you said thriller, but it's more, it is edging into horror in parts, personally, having read both of them. you know, I really enjoyed them, but I know I couldn't write that much horror. So where do you think the line is between thriller versus horror, and you know, any sort of tips for writing that type of material?
It's an interesting question. It's funny that I didn't actually think of myself as a horror writer until I saw books filed under horror on a shelf, and that was a real surprise to me. And I've grown to accept the fact that I am, at least in part, a horror writer. I'm a member of the Australian Horror Writers Association now as well, so I can't really deny it. But I tended to write what I considered to be sort of contemporary fantasy novels that were dark and realistic and gritty. But there are parts that are really, some characters really are violent, and there are some nasty, bloody moments that occur. I mean, the second book is based on a cult that worships blood, so I guess. Yeah, I think trying to deny that I'm a horror writer is, yeah, foolish, but I think it's a case of writing, it comes back down to writing the story that you want to write, and if you have characters, in my opinion, if you have characters that are nasty, evil murderers, but they don't really do nasty, evil murders because you don't want to write anything too horrible, then you're not exactly self-censoring, but you're just drawing away from the story a little bit. Whereas if I've got someone that's, in my stories, like someone that's a blood mage, which means they spill blood in order to make their magic, then they're going to spill blood in all kinds of ways, and they're going to be into that. That's what they do. So I sort of explore that. And I've sort of horrified myself, really, sometimes. Like, I've written scenes and then had to go out for a walk on the beach because it's just hideous trying to get in the mind of the character and then wondering what the hell I've got in my brain. But I think you need to pursue your characters realistically and pursue events realistically. And if that tends to, if that starts to get too much into horror, if that starts to get too gory or too scary for what you really want to do with your book or what audience you want to do, then maybe you need to draw back the story a little bit and adjust the story so that the character's actions are still realistic without being so nasty. And with my own writing, I just tend to follow characters as far as they go. The real world, real life is just shocking a lot of the time. People do hideous things to each other, and I tend to explore that and try not to shy away from it.
No, it's interesting. And a couple of things out of that, you know, some people think horror writers are these sort of twisted people, but we all have some thoughts sometimes that are shocking, but I actually think possibly horror writers are more normal because they get it out of their brains onto the page.
It's true. I've had some people that are completely friendly and normal to me, and then they've read the books and suddenly start giving me like sidelong glances, and you know, if we're walking along, they won't let me walk behind them and things like that. I think people, everybody has this capacity, whether you've got the ability to sort of verbalize it and actually put it down in words and explore the idea in a story or not, but everybody's got this concept. Everybody's got the ability to do really horrible things. Anybody that's been in any kind of war will tell you that, you know, they see people doing horrible things to each other, and in order to survive, it's incredible what relatively normal people can do. So I think anyone can explore those ideas, and if you really don't like it and you really don't want to go there, then you're not going to write it well. But if you're prepared to go there, then you probably can write it well. But it doesn't mean you're a serial killer. I mean, I'm not a serial killer.
No, exactly. You know, that's brilliant. The other question I had was around three-dimensional characters, because, you know, I'm reading a lot about character building, and, you know, they say, don't make your bad guy just a bad guy. He's got to be sympathetic. But clearly your characters are not sympathetic, some of these people. You know, they don't have more a sympathetic side. What would you say to that?
Well, I think that's a slightly limited instruction that you just quoted there. I think it's true that you don't necessarily want characters that are just all bad and one-dimensional evil, but that doesn't mean that they can't have history. I think the point is that you need history in a character. In Realm Shift, in the first book, there's a character called Carlos who is clearly nasty. He just does nasty things. He doesn't care about anybody else, and he's just an asshole. And that in itself fundamentally starts off as one-dimensional, but then as you get some of his backstory, then you can sort of see where he came from. You can kind of see what turned him into the person that he is. And then the character themselves might not be sympathetic, but that doesn't matter. So long as the reader has some sort of sympathy towards the character, then that will make the character three-dimensional. And even if it's the sort of character that you just want nothing to do with, if you knew about them, you'd be horrified, you want them locked away, you might even kill them yourself for the good of humanity. If you can see where they came from, and if you can see why they're like they are, you will have a certain empathy with what they're doing, even though you don't like it. And that's what makes a three-dimensional character. You don't have to have good guys that can do a bit of bad, or bad guys that will do a little bit of good at the end just to make you feel okay about it. You just have to know why they're like they are, and then you will roll with the character.
No, that's a good tip. And I guess as well, you've got some sort of archetypal characters in your book, and you know, religion often does have these archetypes in myth, and if you stray away from what those archetypes are known as, then people get quite upset anyway, don't they?
They do, and if you are going to stray away from it, you need to have good reason for it. Like, you need to weave into it exactly why you're doing what you're doing. I think it's one of the hardest things with writing in characters and in stories, is that you need to keep the reader coming along with you all the time. And at the point where the person's reading and then they suddenly stop and go, hey, why did that happen? Or why did they do that? That's where you bounce the reader out of the story, and then it breaks the fantasy for them. So all the time you're doing things, you have to question, like, would that character do this? Or in the story, you need your characters to get to this certain place by this certain time. So you've got to make it a realistic journey to that point and not sort of shoehorned in for the plot and stuff like that. And I think smoothing those things out to keep the reader rolling along is probably the hardest part of writing.
Mm. Yeah, that's fantastic. Right, we're going to move into the second phase of our interview,
right.
Which is that you are a kung fu instructor and personal trainer, so you're fit and you fight, presumably.
Not so much anymore.
Yeah, but I mean, you have fought, you know, personally, and you do this stuff, and you also write fight scenes and battle scenes, and okay, so I am none of those things, and I'm trying to write a fight scene for my novel with a woman who knows an Israeli martial art and a guy with a gun. So I wondered if you could give us some tips for writing fight scenes.
Yeah, certainly. This is one of those things where you have a certain area of expertise. A lot of the time when it comes to writing a particular character trait, a lot of people would research it. If they were going to write a character that was an Olympic kayaker, then they would probably do some research on what's involved with kayaking and stuff like that, to make it as realistic as possible. The trouble with fight scenes is that everybody's seen the movies, everybody's seen these Hollywood sort of fight scenes, two heroes bashing the crap out of each other until one falls over. But that's actually really unrealistic, and what works on screen doesn't work in books. And with a book, you've got the opportunity to make a really realistic fight scene which can be shocking and which people get hurt, and you can write about how people are feeling inside and stuff like that, all of which is a lot more interesting aspect of a fight scene than just people trading blows on big square chins. So on the one hand, this is, I did a workshop at Conflux last year about this, actually, about writing a good fight scene, and there's, even in a 2-hour workshop, we only sort of scratched the surface because there's so much involved in fighting. But one of the things I would always recommend is that when people are fighting, both people are always scared, which is something that you can portray in fighting without sort of breaking the scene. And it's important to say that both people are always scared unless one person is absolutely superior and convinced of their superiority. Both people will get hurt because you can't have a fight. Even if you just punch someone and they go down on the first shot, which hardly ever happens, you're going to hurt your hand because a head is a hard thing. So these little details will make your fight scene a lot more realistic. And a lot of the time when it comes to the best self-defense, well, you mentioned a gun, the best self-defense against a gun is to run away. So a lot of the time you need to have characters that are finding themselves in a situation where the first thing they're going to be doing is frantically looking for a way to get away, because most of the time people don't want to fight.
Yeah, no, that's a really good tip, actually.
And that's one of my fundamental self-defense tips. When I teach self-defense seminars, it always starts with the same way. If you find yourself in a situation and you think there's going to be a fight, run away.
Right, if okay, so good.
You can run away.
So my character's looking for a way out, but she can't find one. So she has to, you know, get into it. You know, I guess it's not about, you know, then fist went out and connected with, you know, whatever. No. Maybe you could
actually
go into
there
that.
There is one tip we can take from the movies here. The thing that makes someone look like a good fighter in the films isn't necessarily the person fighting, but it's the person getting hit. So when you're shooting a fight scene, doing fight choreography, you can have someone throw the most weird-looking, weak-ass punch, but if the person who's supposedly getting hit has a really good reaction and just sort of flicks back in exactly the right angle with the, you know, the right timing, then that will make that punch look really good. And equally, a bad reaction will make the best punch look ordinary. The same sort of idea you can use in writing. If you just fill a fight scene with lots of technical details, like you said, you know, his right hand shot out, fist clenched, blah blah blah, then it's a lot of clinical detail that gets boring, and you know, you drop the pace of the action. Whereas if you describe the action of or, you know, what's happening to the person on the other end of it, then you make it a bit more realistic. So if you have people that suddenly have white flashes from a blow across the face and they didn't see where the fist came from, that's a lot more like real fighting. So a lot of the time, describing the reactions and not describing in any too great detail the techniques that are being used will make it more realistic. Because even if you have a fight and you win a fight, you don't know afterwards exactly what happened. Like, the adrenaline's going and you think, and you remember certain aspects of it and you're like, yeah, wow, he really got me with that shot there, but yeah, I managed to block that. And you'll remember little bits, but like, if I would fight in competition and fight three-minute rounds, I wouldn't remember 9 minutes of fighting. I'd probably remember about 30 seconds of fighting. So it's that sort of instant in your face as it's happening detail that you want to pick up to make a fight seem realistic. And it doesn't come from a lot of clinical description of techniques and what's happening. It comes from the visceral reaction of people and what's happening to them and what they're feeling.
No, that's brilliant. That's really helpful. Do you know, here's an idea. You've got to write an e-book on how to write fight scenes.
Maybe I should.
I should
convert my workshop into a manual, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Seriously, I think lots of people would be very interested in that, because so many of us writers, you know, we sit in front of our computers and make stuff up. But, you know, you've actually got this experience, which is, you know, really important. So, yeah, there's an idea for you.
Yeah, it's a good idea, because it does bother me when I'm reading an otherwise great book and I'm really enjoying it, but then there's a fight scene and it's suddenly just so unrealistic. And to people that don't know fighting, they wouldn't necessarily pick up how unrealistic it is. They'd be prepared to accept more. I know I'm a much far harsher critic. You know, I've made my career for 30 years of martial arts, but if people don't know fighting, but they read a well-written fight scene compared to a sort of stock standard fight scene, even though they won't know why, they'll know that one's a lot better than the other. So, yeah, it's important, I think. Yeah, maybe I should write the book, see if I can get better fight scenes out there.
Yeah, no, brilliant. Okay, so before we finish, I do have another question for you, again, moving into another different vein. So you started off as an independent author, self-publishing your own books, then you started a small press. Now you've been picked up by another small press, Griffin Wood, and, you know, presumably you'd be interested in a major publisher also picking you up. So what is your, I guess, your idea around indie publishing versus big publishing these days? And are you turning your back on the indies out there?
I knew I was going to start getting these questions.
Yeah.
No, certainly not. I think... The face of publishing is changing. There's no question of that. There's two sides to this. On the one hand, any kind of self-publishing has a lot of stigma attached. And it's well-deserved, because a lot of self-published stuff is bad. Even if somewhere in there is a fundamentally good story, a lot of the time when it's self-published, it's either poorly written, poorly edited, there's errors and, you know, punctuation, typesetting errors, or really, you know, amateurish looking covers and all this sort of stuff. Yeah, a lot of that stuff does stack up to give self-publishing a bad name, and it's well deserved, because you can't expect people to take self-publishing seriously when any experience they've had of it has been a really poor book that they just couldn't read, they couldn't get through. So on the one hand, it's always going to struggle against that. On the other, the face of publishing is changing, and people can use print-on-demand technology and ebooks, and they can get their stuff out there. And I think at this stage, I'm certainly not against indie publishing. I've really enjoyed indie publishing. I originally self-published Realm Shift through Lulu, and then once I'd written Mage Sign, I set up my own small press, cutting out the author services, went directly to the print-on-demand printers to get a better cover price, and I re-released Realm Shift along with the release of Mage Sign. And it was really important to me to have a product that was indistinguishable on the shelf from any other book. And hopefully I've done that. Like, you know, I've seen my books in bookshelves, and when they're sitting there on the shelf, like often... if it's alphabetical, so I'll find my books next to Stephen Baxter, the science fiction writer, and stuff like that. And you see these things in there, and I want people to just look along a shelf and not pick out my book for all the wrong reasons. Go, look at that thing. What the hell is that? It's awful. So I think it's really, really important for people that are going to follow that indie path to take it really seriously. And that means getting someone to help you with cover design if you can't do it, getting someone to help you with typesetting if you can't do it, making sure that your work is edited and copy edited. You cannot do it yourself. Doesn't matter how good you think you are, you know what you've written and you can't spot the mistakes you've made. You have to have someone proofread it and pick up those typos. You have to join writing groups and critique groups so that you can chat about the story, because you might think you've written the most fantastic thing in the world, and good on you. If you wrote a novel, then that's brilliant, because you did something that so many people want to do but never even got that far. But you can't think that because you've done that, it's perfect. When, as a writer, you have to have a very thick skin, put it out there to other people in a critique group and just say, okay, what do you think? And listen to what people say so that you can turn that sort of rough diamond into a gem. Like, if you've got a story in there, other people will help you get the good story out. So it's really important, if you're going to go the indie route, that you follow all those things. But of course, it's hard work. It takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of effort, it takes pulling favors from friends or paying an editor and stuff like that. So, you know, you need to decide really whether you want to do it. And that's the only way that self-publishing and indie publishing is going to shake off this stigma, is if enough people do that.
Oh, that's brilliant. So good. So you haven't turned back on us.
No, I'm a big fan of indie publishing. I mean, I've come a long way through releasing my own things. But Realm Shift originally, it scored me the agent. I had one of the best agents in Sydney that picked up and represented the book. They started chopping it around publishers. One of the big publishers almost went with it and then changed their mind at the 11th hour. And I got that close to the standard traditional publishing deal in the first place. But when that all sort of fell over, I'd had enough for then. And I was like, you know what, sod it, I'm just going to carry on writing. I'm just going to write the next book that I've got in my head, which was Mage Sign. And it was while doing that that I discovered this whole new world of places like Lulu, Print on Demand, ebooks, and all this sort of stuff. So just for the sake of it, I decided to give it a stab with Realm Shift just to see what would happen. And I self-published Realm Shift through Lulu and started getting some really good reviews, started getting really good feedback on the book. And that just set me on this path that eventually I ended up setting up Blade Red Press and re-releasing those. And we're actually putting together an anthology of short stories at the moment. And it's going to be a great book. We've got 14 really good, dark, speculative fiction stories. And hopefully that book will be out in a couple of months, hopefully sort of April, May time. And I've really enjoyed the process of learning about publishing and distribution and all those things I mentioned before, like design and typesetting and all that stuff. But fundamentally, I am a writer above and beyond anything else, and I want to be a writer, not a publisher. So if I can get myself to a point where other people will publish my stuff and do all that stuff for me, then that's fantastic, especially if I then get, obviously, the distribution channels and everything that goes along with it.
And I think that's true of most of us who are doing the sort of indie author thing, is all of us would love a, you know, 10-book deal with HarperCollins or, yeah, you know, whatever. All of us are still pro-publishing in all Absolutely. Of its forms, but we basically are not going to sit idly by with manuscripts in the drawer.
I mean, my books have gotten some fantastic reviews. They've got, you know, I've sold quite a few books and people have really enjoyed them, and I've developed my career as a writer through doing these things with my books, and I've really enjoyed it along the way as well. So, and it's also really helped me improve as a writer. I've become a better writer as I'm going along. One of the best things about this Griffinwood deal is it's given me the opportunity to edit both Realm Shift and Mage Sign again. And even though I was really happy with the books that were out there, every time, I mean, you know, probably know yourself, a book is never finished. You could go through it and just sort of fine tune it and tweak it and polish it and reduce it down to a super powered haiku in the end if you were left to it. But it's good that this is sort of constant ongoing process, and they're all little steps, but they're continuing steps. So if it eventually leads to the big publishing deal, then that's great, and if it doesn't, that's still great. I'm writing, I'm doing what I enjoy doing.
Brilliant. Right, so where can people find you and your books?
You can usually find me hunched over a laptop. you can find all about me at alanbaxteronline.com. And there's all kinds of stuff there. There's excerpts in the books and there's some short stories and that kind of stuff. You can find me at Alan Baxter on Twitter, which is A-L-A-N-B-A-X-T-E-R. And the books, the best place to shop for the books at the moment is through Amazon or amazon.co.uk if that's where you are. If you're in Australia, special offer for the Australians, there's been a short print run of the books done here in country. So within Australia, domestically, I can get books to you directly. So if you're in Australia and you're interested, then give me a shout. You can find my email address on my website, and there are PayPal options there, and I can send you signed copies directly from my own grubby hand. So yeah, search around. Just if you stick Alan Baxter author or Alan Baxter novel into Google, and I think you'll probably find a bunch of hits about me.
Brilliant. Well, thanks ever so much for your time, Alan. That was really great information.
No problem. No, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You can get more information on writing, publishing options, sales and promotion for your book at www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And you can also get your free How to Be an Author workbook at www.howtobeanauthor.com. See you next time.